Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about classic work in management and organizational studies. This is episode 61, where we are discussing Dan Brass's paper, Being in the Right Place, a Structural Analysis of Individual Influence in an Organization, originally published in Administrative Science Quarterly in 1984. Participating in the discussion, there is Catherine, our guest Sarah Ottner, and me, Pedro. This is the second and final part of the episode in which we explore the relation of the text to some contemporary discussions on social networks, organization structure, and power, and also tie up the conversation. So, if you haven't listened to part one, it might be worth doing so beforehand, as this is when we examine the main ideas in the paper. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. So we are back for part two, and now we're going to try to make sense not just of the paper, but what kind of influence it has had in management theory and practice, and what can we learn, what are the waves it has made, and the different dimensions that we think that are, you know, points of strengths and weakness as well. So to start things off, since we have an expert today, and someone that is very passionate about the paper, so maybe Sarah, can you tell us, how has this paper influenced your own work on social networks?
So with my current work, all of my projects look at social status, and specifically I look at prizes and competitions for prizes and awards. So in that sense, it might not seem like this is a direct line between Brass and my own work, which is true. But there are a couple of other projects I've been involved in where these discussions over who makes the decisions structurally and the consequences of those decisions, that is the sort of red thread in all my work. So I have a paper that we published last year in Network Science that is about how little information is required for individuals to perceive a status hierarchy. And in specifically how little network information is required to give to individuals before they construct the network and the hierarchy. This paper about very small networks in his textual descriptions, A and B and C, the smallest network you can have, that is directly related in that way. The indirect relationship, I think, makes more sense for me and my scholarly development. So we'll talk about the papers that this paper has inspired. I've already mentioned Ron Burt's book on structural holes and Adam Kleinbaum's paper that won the scholarly contribution to ASQ in 2018. But there are other works that use networks or that use this structural perspective to look at individuals in their environment that I use in many of my different projects.
So in a way, this has been very much a paper that has been a catalyst for discussion, so to speak.
Yes, I don't think I would have found it myself if I needed to do a literature review for the papers I'm writing now. I don't think I would have reached as far into this. If it hadn't come to me, let's say, during my doctoral development or some of the early projects I was doing, it wouldn't have been as interesting for me to dive into or as powerful for my decisions going forward. Happy accident, as it were.
Great. So power and structural properties, influence, all these things are very much part and parcel, I think, daily life in organizations and at the workplace for many people. So I was wondering, Catherine, what was your impression in reading the paper and thinking about your own work experience? You know, what kind of bells and what kind of aspects of it resonated with your practice?
Well, there's a couple of things that came to mind, and it's interesting in the discussion in the first half about kind of the mixed methods. And I was very interested to read about the questions that were asked about who is influential in the organization and who has clout. And it's a really topical and important question that we ask all of ourselves all of the time. And it just really goes to the method of research, actually. I do wonder how kind of predictable perhaps some of the answers given were, that the dominant coalition, members of the dominant coalition, were listed as influential. And I just wonder if there had been more qualitative elements to it, would more nuance around influence have come through? Because I think oftentimes I see in the workplace where there are employee surveys, more the quantitative methods of asking questions, it's you kind of get the expected answer where the expected sources of power are listed as influential. And of course, there's lots of reasons behind that. Potentially, they can be politically sensitive to say who has influence, because sometimes who has influence isn't the person with the power, which comes from structure. Taking that further, just seeing the going through the journey of reading the paper and seeing that ultimately, in the end, the structure is the source of the power ultimately, regardless of the influence, I think is very true. And I was very interested to read, and we touched on it in the first half as well, about the exceptions to this. And we touched on, to begin with, the person who worked in the company the longest, I think it was, didn't have influence. And the other person who had less influence as well was people in liaison positions. And I thought that was very interesting. I just question a little bit the relationship between influence and power. Is there still an element of shifting power or kind of temporal power in influence? It's just that real power is long lasting because it comes from structure, and influence moves with time.
Well, probably one of the lenses we have to take historically here is about mobility. About upward mobility within an organization, but also individual mobility across organizations and development. So my understanding is that at the time that this was studied, you're still looking at a very large part of the population doing lifelong careers, you know, retiring 50 years of service with a golden watch, for example. So what you needed to be mobile, the power you needed as an individual, was less important than how you could serve the organization. Is that right, Pedro, with what you know?
Yes, no, I totally agree. So I want to unpack a bit that, because there is a lot very interesting here. And I think that also echoes some of the work I have done in terms of bureaucratic organizations. So, first of all, I think the issue, and Catherine highlighted that, is that we can think of influence, or even power itself, in different varieties, you know, not only as this block or one-time thing or stable, but also as something that can exist in relation to a specific task, in relation to specific situations, in relation to specific projects, you know. So let's think about the case par excellence of people in large complex organizations that are in a staff position, which have the mandate to influence line operations. We can think about, you know, more recently of the entrance of experts and specialists of all kinds, from diversity officers to safety professionals that are trying to influence how operations are run, but do not have necessarily a formal position, and therefore the authority and power that comes with, you know, a specific office. But what I think is interesting, and people that study experts in organizations and people that talk about expert authority showcase that there are, of course, multiple mechanisms through which these categories of workers manage to achieve. You know, I'm thinking, for example, about the work by Ruth Ann Husing, published also in SQ, on how what she calls scut work is a way through which professional authorities produce, the extent in which professionals get understanding and connections with the professionals they are trying to influence, you know, gives them some kind of leverage. So I think that's what's one of the interesting to look at the paper and see how the conversation about power and influence has expanded and showcased, you know, a much more nuanced understanding. And I think that's only normal. You know, I think good social science and science in general is always about more fine layered understanding of the phenomenon.
And we have the same discussion in status research about the differences between power and status and reputation. And actually, this brass paper is cited in what to me is a canonical reference for power and status, the McGee and Galinsky 2008 Academy Annals article. So those same distinctions need to be drawn in any of these cognate constructs. And I think the way they are defined in these benchmark papers then becomes the standard.
There was another aspect, I think, from the exceptions that is, discussed in the paper. I mean, it's so funny that we, the apparent footnote is actually so rich. And I think it has to do with something that Catherine was saying as well on how power and influence is very much a going concern for anyone in an organization of anything, if anything, even in social life. You know, it's something that we as humans always think about in relation to ourselves, in the relation to people around us and trying to figure it out, who is more powerful, who gets to control, who gets to push for things, who to whom we can attribute specific decisions. And I think that one thing that also in the last paragraphs of the paper and, that is shadowed in the overall paper is the extent that just being promoted, this signal shape the very way people think about their peers. Again, the case of the long-term employee that was not promoted to a supervisory role probably make people look at this person as not having the standard quote-unquote, influence or power. But again, it's this very tangential signals that we use to attribute and categorize that have almost like self-fulfilling or performative impact.
But in a way, isn't it just an artifact of the method? So at the time, the method involves recall of names. In case the audience is unfamiliar with, let's say, the evolution in network methods. So this is the very beginning of asking people to generate name lists. There's a second phase of network methods where you pre-populate the matrix or the list with every individual in the unit or the team or the entire organization, if that's your site, and participants select from pre-populated individuals. And then, as I said earlier in the discussion, we also now have these surveillance methods and even live methods like RFID tags on name tags during a party to watch patterns of movement and interaction. So there are different changes to the methods over time. And so part of that discussion of who is actually influential, asking participants to report that is, I think, related to the method that was used at the time to collect this information.
Yes, totally, totally agree. So the other thing that we also touched upon is not only the nature of the method, but the nature of the organization and how organizations, I don't want to do the whole discourse of, everything is different now, but certainly there are some different expectations we would go into, what organization today. So, for example, you're talking about the whole story of the long-term career, which was standard in large organizations that today is less so. There is one aspect, but I think the other aspect, again, is that sometimes, even in large organizations, especially ones that are, related to complex engineering, they're producing complex technology, there is multiple hierarchies. So there is multiple mobilities that are related not to progress towards supervisory roles, so the managerial ladder, but also the expert ladder. Think about Boeing and the technical fellows. IBM has a similar system. So this idea of, again, thinking about power and influence in different ways in relation to different ladders, so to speak. So not to say that the paper is not relevant, but just try to think about how organizations have moved, and some of the findings, I think, would warrant being revisited, and it would probably be very interesting to try to see in the case of multiple career ladders what happens to some of the patterns and dynamics mapped.
Yes, and like I said, with the overlap with status literature, there's also an overlap that Brass makes explicit with the reputation literature that's being developed around this time. And the same discussions they have about reputation within a firm, a local reputation versus a global reputation, and which are character-based judgments and which are competence-based judgments. So again, with the historical lens on, most of these reputational measures and relational measures were explicitly asked within firm, but also only exist in the perception of others. And that's something that becomes important for the reputational research that starts developing around now. It's the beginning of the section on assessing influence. They fully acknowledge that it's perceptions of power. And he calls them straight out reputational measures. Such reputational measures assume that those asked are knowledgeable about power, that they are willing to divulge what they know, and that the process of asking does not create the phenomenon.
So let's try to think about the paper in terms of thinking the overall organizational scholarship. You know, in the last part, you, Sarah, talked about on how it has had an influence, interesting choice of words, in a number of discussions on positive scholarship, creativity, ethics, social capital, visibility, and status. So let's try to think what exactly has it contributed to these different conversations.
Well, I went through some of the papers that I think our audience would recognize, but might not have realized that they were citing Brass or using Brass's 84 paper. So to begin with, there's a pair of papers by Herminia Ibarra in 93 AMJ and a 93 AMR. And in those two papers, they're using this networked influence as a way of trying to look at, I would say, non-traditional or not expected individuals, which is what Catherine was saying about where the power lies that's not completely overlapping with formal line. So her two papers are there on clearly a direct relationship, network centrality, power, and innovation involvement. Technical and administrative roles. So that's what you're talking about, Pedro, about the role expectation for the individuals, but then also pushing the theory and the conceptual framework on personal networks of women and minorities in management, which, again, 1993, you know, it's getting close to 20 years old already.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, and it's exactly another thing that I was thinking already in the paper is exactly this dimension of, if you will, stuffing, you know, or who as a person and, you know, the demographic characteristics and the nature of the person, the power that being a specific individual brings to a position, you know. So it's interesting to see exactly on how the literature has picked up on that, so to speak.
I did see as well that a year after that paper came out, Brass had another paper looking at the differences between men and women in that context. I think one of the findings was it showed that men were more closely linked to the dominant coalition and therefore more influential, which I thought would be interesting and perhaps a discussion for another day.
No, we can have it now.
Yes, have it now. Have it now.
Yeah. I guess, again, slightly unexpected, the outcome, would it be fair to say? That men were more closely linked to the dominant coalition and therefore more influential and perhaps of its time anyway in a hierarchical organization like that, that men probably were in, we don't know, but, you know, what the positions of power they were in structurally anyway to be nearer the dominant coalition and therefore more influential and what that would be like now, I guess, would be interesting as well. And it depends on the organization, I guess.
I think thinking historically about the paper, imagine back then, you know, imagine that, you know, we had, you know, this paper was coming after, I keep referring to contingent theory because we just had the last episode about that we released. But imagine that you are in a world that you only look at the structural positions, you know, the formal aspects, the formal organizing. And then a paper like this showcases that things like power, yes, they are an effect of structures, but not just the organogram and, you know, the nature of relations among people, which is a pattern, it's formalized, although it might not be formalized in terms of, you know, lines and boxes, kind of overlaid with things like power. And today we talk about, you know, boys' networks and so on and so forth. But I think that exactly what is interesting here is this multiple dimension in thinking of how these different networks are overlaid on each other and reinforce, constrain, and, you know, preserve specific people as maintaining power in organizations, you know. And in a world with filled with sexism, tends to be men.
But you both said that that result was surprising for you. Then the question becomes, even if you bought all of the assumptions and you followed the literature to that point and the method was rigorous, even still, the result became surprising to you. So the question is why? What did you expect and what expectation did it violate?
I think from the conclusion that structure trumps influence, in that you can have as much influence as you like within an organization, but ultimately the structure decides who has the power at the end of the day. I think that when I reflected on my own experience, that made sense to me, definitely. So that didn't surprise me too much. Did you think the same, Pedro, or...?
So maybe I used the words wrong. I don't think I was surprised. I mean, I think the paper was probably surprising for an audience of, you know, what existed in the 60s or 70s of organizational theory. You know, I think it was doing something surprising then. But I think what's interesting that it was missing that we discussed is exactly the demographic characteristics, who is the people that are occupying these positions. You know, this dimension pushed further some of the ideas coming from this paper.
No, it does make sense. I'm trying to connect it to Catherine's observation about the second paper the following year, and then also David Crackhart's papers in 1990 in ASQ and 1999 in the Research and Sociology of Organizations. So Catherine's observation about gender was that it was surprising at the time? No.
Not surprising that men were closely linked to the dominant coalition and therefore were the most influential. Definitely not surprised at that. And certainly in 1983, definitely not surprised.
But maybe what we might say is surprising is that gender issues were enough in the mind, in the forefront, to become part of the studies going forward, but not enough to change understanding or to reveal different patterns. So there's something going on that we decided we needed to add this complexity to our existing projects. And yet the results came out, as you say, as expected.
I don't know if you know anything about the background to it, Sarah. Perhaps you do, but I think it does mention in the paper that the research that's alluded to, well, spoken about in the paper, it was part of a wider study or a bigger study that he was doing at the time, but it doesn't say exactly what that was or what that was for. I presume it was of the same company, but I don't know if we know any background to that.
I'm not sure about which part of this made it into which paper. In general, I think the access to the organization, to the newspaper, was used for multiple studies, which also facilitated going back 3 years later to look at promotion. So the connection was still there.
There is another dimension that I thought was relevant, especially given current literature. I think that what the paper does in terms of pushing the conversation on structure beyond just the former organization and, you know, showcasing these different structural properties related to influence. And I think there is something about centrality and how the centrality of the individual and the extent the, you know, a promotion to the supervisory level happens has to do exactly with the centrality of the person. And this is something that I think people like Siobhana Mahoney, that is study online communities, so cases that, you know, do not follow the traditional form organization. They are organized for sure, and they have structure for sure, but some of it exactly emerging from the communities reflects that. And I'm thinking in particular about a paper that Siobhan has with Linus Dahler called Progressing to the Center. If I'm correct, they show exactly that specific people in the Linux community, specific individuals progress to gain lateral authority in projects, and in terms not of management necessarily people, but being able to coordinate of the work of multiple people and, you know, linked to the extent they take up this role of central in the work process.
Well, I think one thing we have to consider is, what are we talking about when we talk about promotion?
Okay.
What do we get when we get promoted? So there's a satirical or critical observation called the Peter Principle, which says that individuals in a hierarchy rise to the level of their incompetence. So it's essentially another way to think about it is that we promote people who are very good at a task or at a defined set of roles. Let's say best regional salesperson 5 years in a row. But then we promote them to a position of management. Now that you have been the best regional salesperson 5 years in a row, you can start teaching sales seminars to new hires. Or you can start managing the allocation of individual salespeople to regions and offices, you know, for example. So one of the things that we seem to reward individuals with promotion is a complete change of task, routine, and role in the organization. So there might be a way of thinking about that in terms of the brass paper, which says, actually, if we go back and look at who gets promoted, maybe there is a quiet recognition of keeping the powerful and the influential people in opportunities to exhibit that and not necessarily just moving them up a management hierarchy.
Yes, exactly. And I think that is interesting that some of the insights of the paper seems still to apply to the case of a note studied by Chauvin and Linus on, let's call, non-traditional organization, or also, you know, I was thinking about my study in the aeronautical industry and showcasing how multiple career paths kind of, you know, are a way to resolve that because they allow for people to exist and influence and be recognized for that, but as remaining as experts, you know. So I think that is, you know, it's nice to see the kernel that the paper is trying to and how both the literature and the management practice seems to have taken account of that.
And there certainly is a practical element to the paper. It's very much an academic paper, but there is some practical career advice in it, within it as well, for people who want to take that from it, in terms of how to be promoted and, you know, the need for you to develop relationships, particularly more on the technical side, to stretch out beyond your close cohort, your work group, if you are to be promoted and to be noticed.
But it's also this topic, I'm not sure if you know, it's called status multiplicity. So there's a paper by Balazs Kovács and Chengwei Liu on audience structure and status multiplicity. So here what they're talking about is something I alluded to before about having multiple status measures. I talked about it in terms of having a local or a global reputation. So maybe there's something of that already foreshadowed in this paper, which is that there might be multiple relative systems operating at the same time at which a single method with a single set of individuals was only able to capture, you know, this one set. But maybe that goes a long way to explaining some of the exceptions or some of the differential observations that Catherine was raising.
Yes, true. There is another thing that I thought of the paper in terms of, you know, contemporary organizations. And from the organization I studied for my PhD, which was an aeronautical manufacturer, one of the criteria for progression to higher levels of management positions, so, you know, senior manager, director, whatever it is exactly the ability and extent people had relations and familiarity, you know, were known, so to speak, beyond the people that they had direct interdependence with, which is something that, you know, Brass is already trying to get at, which is thinking about these networks, not just related to the work process people are engaged in, but also the relations they have and their position in those ties with the broader organization and people positioned in places that are not directly connected to their tasks.
Yeah. And in a way, if you think about it from the organization's perspective, the only reason an organization would not support something like that, that rich interpersonal development, would be fear of turnover, right? Would be fear of the stars exiting. In any other situation, it would be to the organization's advantage to foster those relationships, to develop those multiplex networks. So that, in a way, that's the way it should be. And this paper is the beginning of showing that that's the way it is, as an exception to previously established rule or understanding.
Yeah, that's true. And just think about all the stuff that we have today from, you know, almost very much formalized ways through which there is this encouragement. So I'm thinking about, you know, the book by Catherine Turco, for example, The Conversational Firm, and how the use of social media is used to kind of promote these connections. But also, I think she talks about hacker nights and all kinds of, you know, corporate events that have this kind of whimsical, but also at the same time kind of mandated dimension, which are set to bring people together to, you know, in the case in the organization, they're trying to foster these connections to leverage creativity, innovativeness, and so on and so forth.
I saw that in firsthand as well with the case study that I did for my master's dissertation. It was a tech organization, and they'd particularly, well, they had a flat organizational structure, but on a completely side point, through various channels, they did create structure in other ways, including WhatsApp, and they had a company app and different ways. But I saw through various prescribed social events how they decided to almost socialize their engineers a lot more, who tended through their personality traits and types to be more introverted, to be very process focused, to help them build their social capital, because they knew they were the future of the company, so that they were suitable for promotion and accepted as such by their peers as influential. And it was quite interesting to see in the ethnographical study examples of people, you know, deliberately supporting each other to become more influential, particularly if they were in inverted commas, the geeky members of the company. And the ones that did reach out and realize that they needed to that to be promoted actually were promoted. So it did make a difference. But they were deliberately teaching that as a company to their employees. It was quite explicit.
Something in what you said that might give us a complication in modern organizations, so therefore a natural jumping off point for future research, is the proliferation of communication channels. So imagine doing this study now. When do you use email? When do you use Slack? When do you use the phone? And which channel or channels, plural, does the external researcher need to access and map to then find the actual patterns of interaction, overlaid with the kinds of cognitive demands of recall that the individual needs to go through to answer the questions as simply as worded in this article? So if we were redoing this article, could we do it? Would we do it? What would it show us with the multiple communication channels that we have in the types of organizations Catherine was describing, or that many of us are familiar with now?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I actually made me wonder more epistemologically, what does it mean in terms of, in an age of easy / hyperconnectivity, how that connectivity translates into influence? Because in the world that Braz was studying, you know, that the assumption, I think, was that the ties that existed were, I don't know, saying deeper is maybe wrong, but, you know, they were of a certain kind. But in a world that you can literally, you know, reach out to almost anyone through all those channels, you know, what does it mean? How much weight does it bring to being connected in certain, in one way or the other?
And also think about, going back to our very first point about the three different networks he intended to study, workflow and communication were separate, and communication and friendship were separate. So even just take a single one of those, even if you tried to look at friendship networks in modern organizations, how you would approach that. What does friendship look like? Do we actually have more friends at work because we spend more time at work? And how do those friendship networks look like? Or are friendship and communication and workflow networks all completely collapsed on each other, which is what happened in the methods section of this paper? So, you know, despite trying to look at these three different networks, there was so much partial and serial correlation that I'm just going to look at communication networks going forward. So like I said before, even that focus on communication networks was a happy accident of a methodological decision. What if we were redoing it now? with what we said about communication channels and multiplex demands and multiple audiences. And we said, actually, I'm only going to look at the difference between friends and workflow. If everything is communication, I'm going to take the position that I'm going to split friends and workflow. So now what would that tell you about power and influence if you were specifically looking at friends and workflow?
I don't know. I was hoping you had the answer, because my answer would be to hope that, you know, you always wish the reality was a bit easier to study. So the first thing would go to the organization and say, can you all people just stop being friends? Or maybe half of the organization, stop being friends so I can study just one variable.
No, we're not looking for a field experiment in friendship formation. I think what we might be able to do, for example, depends on to what extent an organization has channels for people to be their authentic selves. So I think we have to be careful how many of these channels are a curated presentation. And I think of all of them, perhaps maybe Slack has the real expressions built in, but that only works to the extent that individuals forget that Slack is monitored, right? I think it overlays with some of the discussions about authenticity and presentation, which actually both goes forwards and backwards, because it goes to a very Goffman-esque sociology as well, the self in presentation. And
so I will take, you know, the ethnographic approach, because I think that one way to, you know, we said something, I'm going to backtrack it a little bit. Yes, that's true. There are so many communication channels, but it's not necessarily that they generate ties, and not all ties are the same strength, so to speak, or it's not that, that's another thing that's missing in the paper. It's not that all ties have the same meaning, it's not the same kind of influence has the same meaning. So, you know, the way people go about the real flesh and blood interactions are a bit more nuanced than what might appear just looking off, you know, people being hyper-connected because they all have access to social media or Slack or whatever it is. Because, you know, there is an artist that I really like that, quick parenthesis, it would be as if you just said that just because we have all kinds of, you know, friends, quote-unquote, on Facebook, those people are really friends, you know. So I was thinking about an artist that goes around the world and take pictures of her friends on Facebook in trying to showcase exactly, you know, how what appears to be a flat word, it's not, of course, and how much variability and dimensions exists into that. So I think that's one way to start, is to try to tease out the different weight and uses that specific, you know, communication channels bring and how people go about them, and in their use, some of them serve to establish, maintain or not these connections, and how some of these might translate into deeper connections through which they might obtain influence or not. You know, so I think that's the when the difficult analysis comes into play.
But also one part of the depth or the quality of these connections, which is in the paper, is reciprocity.
Yes.
Not just the reciprocity of the connection, do you even mention my name, but the extent, the frequency with which you go to me for these workflows, or your outputs become my inputs, for example. And reciprocity itself is also important in the theory when you think about, back to those definitions, power being the reciprocal of dependence, right? Power being independence, or the reciprocal of dependence. So it's natural that these pieces of information take on a double weight, or they only start to matter when they are confirmed, right? When they are reciprocal. And then that feeds back into the network measures development, which largely happens in sociology and complexity studies for a while. Management keeps borrowing the tools, but the development of the tools happens outside mainstream management, because the math starts to get more sophisticated with directed networks, with counting reciprocity, with inbound and outbound reciprocals. I hope you would agree, a very accessible paper for something that, you know, Pedro, you said you're not a quantitative person, you know, for something that takes on those kinds of topics. For me, that's something that ASQ as a journal always does for me. If I need an article on a topic and it's not something I've been trained in, or it's not my main area of expertise, I will hope to find an article in ASQ that has engaged with that, because that's something that I think the review process helps bring out in the introductions is this accessibility. It's why I wanted to bring an ASQ to this podcast as well.
Just one thing that came to mind for me when I was reading the paper as well, and it's someone that I read quite a bit when I was doing my research, is Luke's. And looking at power and influence from a critical perspective, power coming from structure, just asking the question of both of you as well, what do you think? Influence, is it a level of control as well? You know, and do the staff recognize it as such? Because, you know, when you think of the names that were given when they were asked to say who has clout and who has influence, it was very predictable. So is that because arguably they're being controlled?
I think perhaps it's more about the comparison of the actual versus the ideal. So in a type of study where it was about reporting perceived reality, I think you probably get more of the idealized approach or that mental diagram of the organogram than you might get from the ideal or the invisible.
So I understood Catherine's question a bit different, because I think the interesting thing, if anything, is that exactly there was a lot of agreement in this reciprocity from what I remembered. You know, it's that the way people responded, for the most part, seemed to have a very clear match of the multiple people, you know, making the lists. And I think that reveals the fact that power is a social fact, if we can go with the, you know, sociological Durkheim version, that it's something that does exist in terms that it has a bearing that, yeah, very much felt, which I think that's, you know, what makes social analysis interesting, because these are things that you cannot directly touch, but you can hold and account for and study, because they have a clear consequence and they permeate the way people think about themselves, people relate to each other, and, you know, the way they construct formal structures, the way that the formal structures are inhabited. You know, so it is, in a way, the paper weirdly showcases tangibility as a quote-unquote thing without verifying that too much.
Another reason to bring this paper to this podcast, to the audience, and to, you know, in doing so, argue for its inclusion in the list of classics, even though, as I said myself, it wasn't part of the list of classics I was taught. It wasn't part of the top 10 or even 20 papers that I go back to when crafting my own works. But what I think it has to help scholars' development, doctoral students, junior scholars, or anyone, is to just look at the very classic structure of a paper. So to say, from the beginning, that says, everybody else looks at this, and here are the great benefits of doing so, I'm going to look at something a little bit differently. So therefore, I need to walk you through my thinking and walk you through where I get my assumptions and put my heart on my sleeve. Okay. In this case, it brings in methods and measures from outside and has to justify those choices, and then give us an organization that we as management scholars can relate to, especially here where it makes a clear jumping off from lab studies. That's a specific challenge of the paper. Then being honest with the methods, descriptive, so that we could pick it up now and do the same thing, a real recipe, but also honest. I tried this and it didn't work. Or I did not plan to do this a priori, but when I did it post facto, look what I found. And then, as we've already discussed before, being clear and honest about the exclusions and being generative about the future research and the possibilities. And generative, I think, is really the word, because it has the same root as the word generous, which is that any individual scholar cannot possibly do every project on every topic or own a topic or an approach or a method. So those future research sections must be inspiring to other scholars, but they must also, in a way, give away good ideas. They must give away the next natural extensions. So I think that's something that this paper, as an exemplar, which is to me what your series on this podcast does, is take exemplar papers and deconstruct them. So that's why I thought this paper was very good to go through as an exemplar, because even for people for whom meso-OB, or network methods or multi-research method papers is not their main approach, it's still accessible and therefore it can still be really helpful as a model.
And for all those reasons, it really deserves the hallmark of a classic. So thank you for bringing it to us and joining us.
My great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Any last thoughts? Maybe Sarah has a big, great reflection.
I'm starting a movement right here, right now, on the podcast. Starting a movement for really establishing meso-OB as its own sub-discipline and saying, what does that mean? So that means for me that I look at individuals and small groups in relation to their structures. So the micro being the individuals, the macro being the structures. And that would be where we would put these studies about affiliation networks. You would put them with professional networks. You can put my work on looking at individuals working with stars, star performers, or looking at high performers who don't get a lot of visibility. That all fits in this area as well. So right here, right now, we start this movement.
And that is all for episode 61. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. And please, join us again next month as we discuss another classic work from organizational theory and management on Talking About Organizations.